So hello, everyone, and welcome to the Literacy View. We have a very special guest. I say that all the time because all our guests are so special. And mindful teacher Rachel is here with us, and we are so excited to have her. I have been using Instagram, and it's not really my favorite form of social media, partly because you have to really engage people with visuals and videos, and that's not my thing, but it's absolutely your thing, and you have quite a following, Rachel. So we, Judy and I, are so excited to hear what you have to say and to learn from you. So what caught my eye was actually your name, Mindful Teacher Rachel. And that's what this episode is about. So we want to learn why you call yourself Mindful Teacher Rachel and learn a little bit about your background. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Rachel.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be on this podcast. I am a listener, so it's really exciting. Feels very full circle. So I initially made my username Mindful Teacher Rachel because I feel like in education, I have two loves, two passions. I actually came to education with this passion for social emotional learning, this passion for mindfulness and supporting kind of the whole child in the classroom, as opposed to just focusing on academics. And along the way, I found literacy and the intersection between kind of self-efficacy when it comes to literacy and feeling confident in your literacy skills because you've been taught the code and you are able to read the text in front of you, and kind of the anxiety that ensues when you don't have that. And so I find that there's a really nice intersection between social emotional learning, mindfulness, and literacy. And so that's kind of how my two loves intertwine. So when I first started the account, I thought that I would just mostly share stuff about social emotional learning and mindfulness. I was a very anxious child growing up, and that was something that I really needed in the classroom and wasn't always there and wasn't always a part of my school experience. And I wish it had been. And so when I started to learn about it, in my teacher preparation program, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do in my classroom. These are the kids I want to reach. And these are the, you know, students I want to support and how I want to support them. And I, again, found literacy along the way. And I kind of shifted that so that I share kind of both of those things now. And what I find is great is, when it comes to mindfulness, the same things that help me as an adult or me with my family, or that helped me as a child in my own time, are really helpful in the classroom as well and with children. And so it's something that has really helped me as a person. And I think that connection really helps my students when I teach them different strategies or when we talk about mindfulness, because they know, hey, like it helped her when she was a kid. This is something that I can do and bring into my practice, you know, for how to feel better at school or at home or with my siblings. And so that's kind of how I came to name my account and share information with people all over the world.
So, you know, interestingly enough, fun fact, I was trained in mindfulness through mindful schools. So people, I don't usually share that, but I am certified in this to teach mindfulness. So there is a program out there called Mindful Schools. And I thought one day that I would use it formally, but I actually have my own practice. And I do think it's important to be able to have something, whether it's mindfulness or not, to have some sort of release. So Judy, Rachel mentioned this idea of having anxiety about school. You know, we've spoken about this in working with kids with any learning difficulties. We see this all the time. This is not unusual for us to see kids who struggle and, you know, they go to school and many of them are going to the nurse's office or going to the teacher complaining about different things, but we know it's all stress. So what do you think about this intersection, as Rachel said, this intersection between social emotional learning and literacy?
So I think this is a very interesting topic on many levels. I think that one of the key pieces in order for a teacher to even work on mindfulness with the students is working on how, you know, self-love and self-care for teachers. I think that so many teachers in the last couple of years and in general are really themselves stressed out, right? They're worried about evaluations, teacher ratings. Very often teachers are rated, you're ineffective or you're highly effective. You know, we say not to label kids by reading levels, and we've all shifted from that. However, you know, many school systems still label teachers, and that can have a very detrimental effect on self-esteem for teachers, anxiety for teachers. There's so many things that aren't within teachers' control, like even what curriculum their school is using. Some teachers know structured literacy is the right approach, but they are being told that they have to still use, you know, should I say the word, Faith? Lucy, take a shot. So that causes a level of anxiety.
We play the drinking game. Every time Lucy comes,
say mindful Rachel.
We take a drink. So drink, you know,
yeah, so teachers very often feel like they have no control. Some schools are so rigid. Thank God I'm in a very happy place right now, so I'm thrilled for me. But, you know, I've been around the block for a while. Some schools are so rigid with timing. If your lesson plan is going 3 minutes over and you're not doing what's supposed to be done at that moment, meaning foundations or HMH or Lucy or whatever, you're in trouble, right? Yeah. So I think it's really important when we think about this, the kids are very important, but so are the teachers. So how can we alleviate the stress of teachers and how they're feeling in the classroom? Because if we don't alleviate that burden and that feeling of potential anxiety and depression and so forth, that's going to have an impact on the kids too, right?
So good question.
I'm an anxious person too. I have to be honest. The way that I cope with anxiety myself is really, really going deep into work. The more I work with students, so like even after work, I'm tutoring sometimes two kids a day, or I'm working on this passion project that I'm doing with Faith, doing the podcast. So my mind is so anxious, and the way that I cope with it, I don't know if it's a great coping mechanism, but is doing what I love. Like when I'm working with kids one-on-one in my garage where I'm sitting right now, that sense of anxiety dissipates. But, you know, I think Rachel might have some great tips. And at the end of the day, kids are definitely anxious in classrooms for many reasons too. Some of the kids can't read. Some of the kids read really well and nobody's paying attention to them either, right? So I'm curious to see what Rachel has to say. I'm ready for it, Rachel.
Yeah. Well, the thing that you're talking about, this kind of like distracting, I'm choosing something that's going to distract myself.
Yeah.
It's part of so many strategies for mindfulness, right? You're taking your mind off of something that's it's busy focusing on or it's busy freaking out about, and you're putting it somewhere else so that you're really grounding yourself in the moment. And I struggle with that too. I have a brain that's constantly like going crazy. And I would get to this point where I literally couldn't turn off my thoughts. You know, I'd sit there and try and count to 10 and breathe or whatever, and I just couldn't do it because my mind was just constantly running. And when your brain is in that state of kind of at, like, for lack of a better word, panic, it's very hard to kind of let in any sort of reason or any sort of like really mentally taxing strategy, right? Like, it's hard to, the cognitive load isn't there. It's being taken up by that panic. It's being taken up by that, all of those anxious thoughts. So it's hard for your brain to be working on other stuff, right? Like a very pensive strategy. And so that's where the mindfulness piece for me comes in. It's that step of, okay, wait, I need to shift what my brain is focusing on, get it to a place of not even necessarily calm, but like homeostasis, so that I can start to be realistic and start to implement more cognitively advanced strategies and more executive function in there. It's kind of like that fight or flight moment where your amygdala is going crazy, 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 and none of your adult strategies that you know can take over. And so one of the things that I actually learned in therapy for myself that I teach kids, and it kind of, you know, you see kids with all the different fidget toys, is this practice called bilateral stimulation. And it's kind of like in OG when they talk about crossing the medial line of your body. And it's working on engaging both halves of your brain. And so what you do is you can either tap or some kids like to squeeze, but you're basically doing both hands or both sides of your body. So I will tap my thumb and my forefinger of my right hand and then tap my thumb and forefinger of my left hand, like back and forth, back and forth. It doesn't really matter what speed you do it. But because your body is having to focus on that now, that kind of just subtle movement, it kind of calms down that panic because you're focusing on this very simple movement thing. And kids like it because it's subtle. It's not something that they have to like get up and do. They like to be physical, especially if you have a wiggly kid that's very wiggly because of their anxious feelings. That's somewhere to put that energy. And I've found even as an adult, like, wait, hold on. I gotta stop so that I can focus on that. And then I get to the point where I can get back to reality of, okay, wait, hold on. I'm having these like ridiculous feelings that maybe I need to tone down, or what can I do about these feelings now? So that's kind of a good intro mindfulness thing that I think kids really grasp onto very well, because it's so easy. It's very simple. And if it works for me as an adult with, you know, my big anxious feelings, it works for a kid with maybe a smaller anxious feeling about.
Yeah, Rachel, do you mind if I try it?
Yeah, do it.
Well, I know it's a podcast, so people that are listening might not see me trying it, but I'm the kind of learner that has to try something. Okay. Faith, you going to try it too or no? All right. Did I get it?
Yeah. You could just do it like this. Some people tap their right hand on their right leg and their right hand on their left leg. So just tapping like this.
Mm-hmm. So what I learned, and I think that this kind of follows, is you're trying to disrupt that. The whole point of this is to disrupt the moment of being in this panic, in this stressful state. And sometimes when you disrupt this, it could be through focusing on the breath in and out and just, you know, counting each breath or just following the breath or, you know, it could be in some cases people chanting something that's rhythmic, but all of that is used to disrupt the moment and shift the focus to something to give your body a chance to get out of this state. So
right.
Is that how you
see it? Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. Can I ask you a question? So I know our viewers in general are very much about the research and the science. Is there research that you are aware of behind this kind of stuff that people can learn more about it from that standpoint? Because I know there'll be like some people that might say, where did you get that information? Is it, you know, does it work? Is it proven? Is it not proven? And does it have to be proven? Listen, at the end of the day, if that's working for your kids, that's something, right?
Yeah. So I learned that through a therapist that does cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Another thing that I've done kind of in my own journey that was very interesting, very fun, was something called biofeedback, which is still a field that's growing a lot. And there is a lot of research out there that's very interesting to read. And essentially what they do is they hook up like an EKG to your body, and they're tracking your heart rate and your breathing as you go through different scenarios as you're talking. And eventually you get to the point where you can kind of control your heart rate through your breath, which is pretty cool if you are someone who is prone to panic attacks or even has a high heart rate, or you get too winded and something and you need to calm yourself down. And something that they do is they find kind of your ideal breath rate. So for me, it's 6 breaths per minute. So I know that like every 10 seconds, I need to have a full breathe in, breathe out. And so if I'm ever doing kind of breath work when it comes to mindfulness, there's like apps for biofeedback that will like buzz every time you need to breathe. Or so that you don't have to necessarily like have an EKG hooked up to you. But there's also different like games you can play with biofeedback with kids where it's like you're trying to like jump on the lily pads, and the way you land properly in the middle of the lily pad is by timing your breath the proper way. And so that is a really cool field of research that I had no idea about before I went to, I think I first did that at like the university counseling center where I went. They were doing like some more studies on biofeedback, and they were like, we think you'd be a really good candidate for this because you already know a lot about mindfulness and have a mindfulness practice. And so is this something that you want to try? And I was like, sure, this sounds super interesting. I was like always the student that wanted to be involved in the psych studies. And I was like, I can't wait till we get to the end so you can tell me what this is all about. But so that was a really fun practice that I was like, wow, this has a lot of research behind it that you can meaningfully explain to people in kind of lay terms. Like it makes sense that when you have more meaningful control of your breath, your heart isn't going as wackadoo. Like, I mean, when you go running and you're breathing better, your heart rate stays down more. So it's kind of the same thought there with like exercise, which people use as a release as well. So that's something that you can really dig into the research on. Biofeedback is super, super, super cool. And there's lots of apps out there for like being able to practice that breath work. Because I used to hate when people said, you know, just breathe. And I'd be like, but how? Like, I can't catch my breath, or like, it doesn't feel like it's doing anything. But once you kind of know, usually for people, it's between like 5 breaths per minute and 7 breaths per minute. Like it's somewhere in that range. You can just like set an app or a timer to that. And that's a really cool calm down practice that I like to do and that I can like use with kids as well. Like making sure that we're breathing in a meaningful way rather than just like, okay, well, breathe in, breathe out, you know?
So Rachel, interesting. I mean, one, I just want to mention when you said just breathe, it reminds me of what my husband would say to me sometimes, relax. And that would get me so angry. You know, just hearing him say, relax. Don't tell me to relax. That would make me actually more anxious when someone tells me to relax. So I get you. But I wanted to just ask you this. I'm expecting that people are listening to this, probably saying, oh, what a bunch of nonsense. What a bunch of BS this is, this SEL. And if kids were just taught to read properly, there would be no need for any of this, that they would be calmer. And I mean, there is some truth to that, that obviously not being able to read can make you anxious. But what do you say, Rachel, to the naysayers when that possibly they're thinking, you know what, this is a bunch of BS and schools should all be about academics and that we shouldn't take up school time with any of this SEL kind of stuff. What are your thoughts?
Well, the first thing I do is talk about my own experience because I was a kid who read fine. Like academically, I was always fine and very lucky to be so. The piece that was missing for me was that social emotional learning piece. That was the piece that caused me to get diagnosed with anxiety way later than I should have been, to have access to medication and therapies way later than I should have been, and to not qualify for special ed services, even though I should have. And if I had had that, it would have been a hugely different experience for me. And then another thing to think about too is, regardless of whether your anxious thoughts are about reading, say your anxious thoughts are about the first day of school. Oh my gosh, I don't know anybody in my class. I don't know my teacher. I'm nervous about this transition, right? Everybody has these little nervous feelings. I am very envious of a person in the world that doesn't have a nervous feeling now and then. I think it's very, very common, if not universal. Wouldn't you want some sort of strategy to mitigate that, to make your child feel better and feel safe and feel confident and build that self-efficacy? I feel like if you don't have that, you're at a loss. And if you do have that, maybe it's not always beneficial to you, but it's just another tool in your tool belt for how to access the world. Transition, if that's a difficult thing for you to do, from, you know, a new school year to, you know, the next school year, or from summer to the start of the school year, or from class to class, to do things like calm your body down. If you're a wiggly person after recess and you need that time to get back in the zone for learning. I know some kids who have so many, maybe not anxious thoughts, but their brains are just so busy that they're not at the point where they can access the instruction that I'm trying to give them, because they need that mediating mindfulness, right? To calm down that piece of their brain so that they can get their brain ready for learning. If they've come in from recess and they're obsessed over the fact that they lost a game in recess and it wasn't fair, and I'm still focused on that, but it's language arts time and I'm teaching this phonics skill, that kid is not in a place where they can access that information and apply it with their whole brain, right? They're focused on this other thing. So having a strategy that can help you move from that piece to even access instruction is important for a lot of kids in a lot of different scenarios. And that's where this mindfulness and social emotional learning is important, right? Because we don't want kids to be denied access to instruction if their brains are simply not in a place where they can get the full value, even if the teacher is doing the right thing in terms of teaching literacy in an evidence-based way.
I think that's interesting, Rachel. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that, you know, the good news is, I think I just read in Chalkbeat or somewhere that the mayor of New York City is actually going to be including mindfulness in the classrooms next year. I think if I read it correctly, it was for 5 minutes a day for the kids.
So yeah, it was breathing. I don't know if it was really teaching mindfulness, but there was going to be a focus on breathing and having kids breathe. And it wasn't chalk beat. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that that's definitely on people's radar. And, you know, for some kids, it might be reading problems, but for some kids, some of them are perfectionists. They can't write something. They sit with the eraser. They're erasing a million times. Then there's the kids and the teachers that are people pleasers, right? You just want constant good feedback. You constantly don't feel good enough. How do you learn how to cope for that? Then there's the kids that are too shy to ask for help. They'll sit there while a lesson's going on and they're afraid to raise their hand. So I think creating a culture of love is so important. Creating a space where that time is there and available, and it's not seen as it's taking away from instructional time, is such an important shift. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing in classrooms that I think has to be really thought about a lot is behavior management tools. I think that for so many years, so many of those tools have caused so many students stress, including my own son when he was in first grade. There was like the red light, green light system, and you know, my kid was, when he was little, he was on red, and now the whole class knew that he was on red, and then he would behave poorly. And, you know, those kind of things can really affect kids too. Then there were the systems in classrooms in schools that I've seen where there was a clip system where they would have a clip, and if you're doing great, your clip is high. And if you moved or looked the wrong way, then your clip is getting lower. And if your clip goes down a notch further, it's parent contact. So I think it's important, like, to think about these things in general. And Rachel, what kind of behavior management do you see helps in a mindful classroom? Like,
so I'm extremely like proactive when it comes to behavior management, so yeah, that there's less reactivity that has to happen. And a lot of what I do at the beginning of the year is I have this document that I like share, my team shares it, and it's basically all of the social emotional learning or executive functioning picture books that we have grouped by the skill that it's teaching. So some of them are like the size of the problem. Is it a big problem or is it a small problem? Some of it is like walking out of turn, like interrupting. Some of it is the volume of your voice, depending on the situation. Some of it is like accepting responsibility for your actions. You know, we do a lot of kindness ones too, especially at the beginning of the year, we're with a new group of friends. So how do you support everybody in the classroom? We, you know, the classic, have you filled a bucket today? We do some about expected versus unexpected behaviors, depending on the situation you're in. So if you're outside, it's an expected thing that you're running around and being silly and screaming. That's fine. But once you're inside, that's an unexpected behavior. And so with that list of read alouds is how we structure our afternoon class meetings. And at the beginning of the year, we select pretty specifically of like, okay, these are the things that we need to talk about as we have this new class of first graders who are really doing like truly academic school for the first time. These are things we need to talk about to kind of set those expectations and get their minds thinking about, especially as they're moving kind of out of the egocentric phase, other people and empathy, and making sure that they're operating in a classroom where they're expected to be a little more independent than they were in kindergarten. But then throughout the year, we choose different books from that list to start the conversation for our class meeting. And what's great about centering a discussion around a read aloud, I mean, just as I use a read aloud to like ground, I don't know, when we're teaching topics in science and social studies, is these books are written in a way that give kids language to talk about these things that are a little more abstract and in a way that feels safe. Like, we're not talking about so-and-so doing the wrong thing who's sitting next to me. We're talking about Johnny in the book who doesn't have any personal space boundaries. And that's something that we need to work on as a class.
We're talking a lot now about early childhood. And before we started, Rachel, we both said, oh, I taught first grade. You're presently teaching first grade. And Judy, of course, is an early childhood coach. And so we all have experience in early childhood. And I also taught upper grades as well. So as you're talking, I'm thinking about those kids in the upper grades. Is there something that we're missing for those kids? Because at this point, some of the things you're talking about, like a read aloud, would not apply to them. So are there tips for parents, let's say, who have older kids? What could be done for them? And also, what can parents do for themselves, because they are role models for kids and how they handle stress?
Right, right. So I teach at my school, in addition to first grade, I run the after-school theater program, which is fourth through eighth grade. And so that's a really fun experience to get to work with those kids in a discipline that is very social, emotional based, right? You have to be very in touch with your emotions to be a theater teacher. And something that I notice with them in particular is a grounding activity or a start to a conversation might be a theater game, or it might be a like an art immersion thing. You know how people go to like paint and sip, or they'll go to a relaxing art class. There's something about the theater room or the art room that really just opens those kids up to being able to have access to talking about their feelings and experiences and stuff like that. When I run this program with the art teacher who does a lot of the theater tech. And so sometimes we'll be in the art room making set pieces and stuff with the kids. And sometimes I just kind of sit there and I'm listening to like what, you know, the conversations that are going on, and I'll pipe in every now and then. I'll say, so it sounds like this is happening in this science class. Is that right? Can you explain that to me more? And the kids are just more willing to open up around this kind of collective art-based activity, right? That doesn't feel like a little kid thing, like a read aloud, but is something that is getting them in touch with their emotions, is making them feel like they're in a safe and, like, for lack of a better word, creative space, because you have to be very vulnerable to be creative. And I think when we get to kids who are between like 10 and 14, they are not vulnerable with adults. They like do not want to be that way. That is a really special experience that I've noticed across the board with kind of arts education that I guess aligns so well with social emotional learning and those kinds of conversations that apply to kids at that age.
That's so interesting that you say that, because what I'm hearing from you is that school is traditionally language-based, right? School is language-based, but when you're doing something creative, whether it's art or acting or music, and you're getting in touch with that other side, it opens kids up to be able to talk about things that maybe they wouldn't be comfortable talking about in the traditional subject areas. I mean, that's what I'm hearing. Judy, anything you want to add to what you've heard, or any questions that perhaps I missed along the way?
Well, first of all, Rachel, I want to give you kudos, because, you know, school, people think it's about just reading, math, knowledge building, and all of that. You're definitely building kids' knowledge by giving them life skills. And I think that, you know, we take things for granted. We think that kids know how to have a filter. It doesn't come naturally for a lot of kids. We think that kids know how to be very organized with their folders. It doesn't come naturally for a lot of kids. And just being compassionate and mindful enough to know that kids need help. Teachers need help. Kids need help. And giving that time to devote to that is so important. So my question to you is, Rachel, so you're doing a lot of these great things, it sounds like. Is it Rachel's doing this all by herself, or is this like a school-wide, we're all in this together, we're speaking the same language, we have a vision of where we're going, we know what kind of read-alouds we're reading this year versus next year, or is it like Rachel's
doing this? That's a great question. Yeah.
So when I chose my first school, I was just so happy to get a job that I didn't feel like I vet the administration and the school culture as much as I should have. And so my experience was not that great. And because my experience was not that great, my students' experience was not that great. I was really limited. I was in a really rigid environment. I was using a curriculum that I knew was not evidence-based, but I had to get the data. There wasn't a lot of time for social emotional learning and mindfulness, even though the school like wanted that to be a thing. And so when I knew I was leaving that school, I was very intentional about the school culture that I wanted to be a part of from a literacy standpoint and from a social emotional learning executive functioning standpoint.
Yes. It makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of pre-service teachers are so happy to get a job anywhere, which like it's hard to get a job, right? It's a challenge. It's putting yourself out there. And there's like a lot of rejection there. That they're willing to, I guess, give up some values because they just want a place, or, you know, it's more convenient. And of course, you know, not everybody is privileged enough to have a situation where they have a choice, whether it's because of like where they live, or it's because like I have to be in this district because they pay the amount that I need. But if you can choose an environment for yourself really intentionally and ask those questions when you're interviewing, like people who are interviewing love it when you ask really in-depth questions because it shows how thoughtful a candidate you are. That can give you a better idea of the situation you're getting into and how you can help grow that program. So I have like set very little of this up all by myself. I created our spreadsheet of social emotional books, but like our school had a lot of those. I was just putting them in a spreadsheet and organizing them by skill set, right? And the fact that my school supported me in allowing me to do that and jumping on to make it a team-wide thing was a really big deal. Some schools would not allow you to take on that role, especially as like a young early career educator. And so I think choosing a school, or even finding your like marigold teacher, finding your like what I call my school mom, of who will support you in doing those things, in kind of whatever school environment you can, gives you kind of the energy and direction you need to be able to start implementing those things and feel like you have the self-efficacy to make a change. If the school doesn't necessarily have that system started out, it like definitely broke my heart leaving my kids at my first school, knowing that like it wasn't the ideal environment for me or necessarily for them. But because I did, and because I'm at the place where I am now, I'm able to run my Instagram because I feel supported and empowered to share all this stuff and explore all this stuff and get more advanced OG training and take more other trainings in literacy or mindfulness and social emotional learning. And so then I'm helping tens of thousands of people, which makes me feel like choosing that path actually allowed me to have a greater impact on families and children and other teachers.
So it just goes back to what Judy was saying from the beginning of our podcast, is the importance of teachers feeling calm and supported, relaxed, and able to do their jobs, right? That's so important. And when we are relaxed and confident, those kids will feel better as well. So I think there's a cycle here of the parent, the teacher, and the child all needing these skills. And yet society doesn't always support the importance of having these strategies available to us. So any last thoughts before we wrap up, Rachel, that we didn't cover that you would like to say or mention? I just want to say first, before anything, how impressed I am with you. I mean, you're young and energetic and brilliant and caring. I mean, you have all of the traits that I think any parent would say, boy, am I lucky my child has Rachel as a teacher. So I just wanted to put that out there. But if there's anything that we left out, Rachel, please jump in and say something.
I mean, I feel like we covered a lot of stuff and made a lot of connections. And I just wanted, you know, this is the literacy view. So it predominantly talks about literacy, but I think that there is a fundamental connection between literacy and social emotional learning, whether it comes from students who are struggling readers and need that social emotional learning too, to help them build that self-efficacy back up along with learning the skills, the code that they need to, and the knowledge they need to, but also that social emotional learning to help all kids access academic information as well. I think they really go hand in hand. And I think if you're leaving out kind of either end, the academic piece, the evidence-based academic piece, or kind of the whole child social emotional executive functioning piece, you might not be supporting all that a child needs. And so I think it's an important part of the literacy conversation that I'm just feel very grateful that you've allowed me to have with you. And I am excited to see what teachers do with it in the future, how they combine kind of those two things in a way that best supports kids.
Yes, I actually talked about this in my book, Failing Students or Failing Schools. That's a big component of my book, with tips for parents as well, and really for anybody. Judy, did I leave anything out, or did we leave anything out that you think we should mention here?
Rachel, I want to commend you for having courage to find your happy home. I think that's such an important thing that people do. We are not powerless. We do have options out there. And sometimes it's really hard to make changes. And sometimes it's scary. And sometimes you're like, oh, I better just suck it up. It's fine. This environment is fine. I'll be the happy person in this miserable place. But, you know, we matter. We as educators matter. And, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years. I've had some really happy homes that I loved. I've had happy places that I left because I knew I professionally had to grow. But I've also been in buildings that were not the best fit for me on a social emotional level, or maybe in terms of how a building saw literacy and so forth. So A, I commend you for having the courage. I commend myself for after 25 years having the courage. It took me a while to get to that place, but I knew I had to find a happy home. And I think I'm on my way to a very happy home as well, still with New York City schools, thank goodness. But kudos to you, to all the teachers and listeners out there. Find your happy home. And if you don't have a happy home, or if you do have a happy home, at least try to use some of the tips that Rachel gave us. Let's all expand and keep this conversation going. I just feel like going like this for a little while, because I do have those ruminating thoughts that go through my head all day. Like, oh my God, I have to do a PowerPoint presentation next week and it's not going to be good enough. And what if I don't put enough science of reading quotes and researchers? You know, there's always that feeling. But I think part of what Rachel really brought to light is those feelings are normal. Every single person exhibits them in different ways, whether you're a struggling reader or whether you're a gifted kid that has, you know, your own quirky little things going on, like you're a little bit maybe socially awkward or you have no filter or your binder's a hot mess. We all have issues. And I think that if we start realizing that it is part, you know, as teachers, we're not all psychologists, but cultivating a classroom environment and cultivating a happy building environment is so important. And the last thing that I wanted to say is very often when you walk into a school building, and I know, Rachel, you probably walk into a lot of buildings, and Faith, you probably have, you could feel culture very quickly and you could see joy on teachers' faces very quickly and on kids' faces very quickly. And when the kids don't look happy, there's a reason. And when the teachers don't look happy, there's usually a reason too. And having those conversations and not being afraid and not, you know, thinking you have to just stay silent and like just suck it up or fake it till you make it doesn't have to be the solution. There's help.
Yes. And my last thought is, you know, I've been doing this for over 35 years as an educator. And in all those years, I recognize that the kids who are either out there acting out or they're withdrawn, it's one or the other, you know, that it's because they are really suffering in one form or another. And we can't just say, okay, everything is about just instruction. These are people, you know, we have to realize that we're dealing with human beings. And I think what's getting lost in this science of reading conversation is that there's a whole school day. It's not just about teaching this one subject. And we have to recognize the importance of people's emotional state. So thank you for joining us, Rachel. And people could follow Rachel on her Instagram, which is Mindful Teacher Rachel. She's also on Twitter. I forget your name on Twitter, Rachel.
Mindful Teacher was like taken. So I think it's Teacher.
Or Rachel something.
Let me look it up because I forgot it.
You know what? You can always give it to us. I'll put it in the show notes. You can email it.
Yes. It's Teach Rachel Soar. So the word teach and then my name and then S-O-R, like science of reading.
S-O-R, that's what I remember, S-O-R being after your name. All right, so thank you everyone for joining us. As you know, this is the summer series that Judy and I are working on, self-care. What's next is going to be very exciting. We're going to be talking about nutrition and exercise, and that's coming up. And so we are really looking at different pieces of the puzzle here this summer. So I hope you join us, and we'll be talking about the next special guest coming up. So thank you.
Bye. Facebook, The Real Teachers Letting Loose, The Literacy View. Follow Faith on Twitter at Faith Berkowski. Follow myself at Boxner Judy. And if I forgot something, you know where to find us.
Exactly. All right. Good night, everyone.